Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
In his new book, The Fourth Age, Smart Robots, Conscious Computers, and the Future of Humanity, futurist, technologist, and CEO of GigaOM, Byron Rees, makes the case that technology has reshaped humanity just three times in history. 100,000 years ago, we harnessed fire, which led to language. 10,000 years ago, we developed agriculture, which led to cities and warfare. And 5,000 years ago, we invented the wheel and writing, which led to the nation state. He tells us that we are now on the doorstep of a fourth age brought about by two technologies, AI and robotics. His book provides an essential background on how we got to this point, and how, rather than what, we should think about the topics we'll soon all be facing, such as machine consciousness, automation, changes in employment, creative computers, radical life extension, artificial life, AI ethics, the future of warfare, superintelligence, and the implications of extreme prosperity. By asking questions like, are you a machine? And could a computer feel anything? Rees cultivates discussion at the cutting edge in robotics and AI, and provides a framework by which we can all understand, discuss, and act on the issues of the fourth age and how they'll transform humanity. Byron Rees is the CEO and publisher of the industry-leading technology research company GigaOM, and the founder of several high-tech companies. He has spent the better part of his life exploring the interplay of technology with human history. Rees has patents, obtained and pending, in disciplines as varied as crowdsourcing, content creation, and psychographics. The website he has launched, which covers the intersection of technology, business, science, and history, have together received over 1 billion visitors, and he is the author of the acclaimed book, Infinite Progress, How Technology and the Internet Will End Ignorance, Disease, Hunger, Poverty, and War. And today, he joins me to talk about his new book, The Fourth Age. Hello, my name's Carrie Lynn Evans, and you're listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, my guest is Byron Rees, who's agreed to talk with us about his new book, The Fourth Age, Smart Robots, Conscious Computers, and the Future of Humanity. Byron, thank you so much for joining us.
Carrie Lynn, thank you for having me.
First, maybe start by telling us a little bit about yourself, the companies you're associated with, and how you came to work in your field.
Well, I'm a publisher of GigaOM, which is a technology research company. And I guess I came to work in my field because when I graduated from university in the early 90s, I looked around and technology seemed to be this thing that was going to be the juggernaut that drove the world for the next several decades. Technology is really kind of this really cool thing. It multiplies what people are able to do. It's almost like magic. And I knew whatever I did, I wanted to be involved in that. And so I've always been with startups and started companies and always with technology.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that about the 90s, because I feel like that was a point in time where it seemed like technology was something you could opt into. Whereas I don't think people would have that perspective now. It seems like a given. You have to learn, you have to get involved, otherwise the world passes you by.
Yeah, that's a really interesting insight. I would say I had never thought about it that way, but I think you're entirely right.
Okay, well, tell us how you came to write this book in particular.
I got interested in the story of competing narratives. So you hear people on both sides of the artificial intelligence. So I think with regards to artificial intelligence, there's three big questions. There's what's it going to do to jobs? And is it something we should be afraid of? Is it going to like go rogue? And maybe less big, but still kind of interesting, is can a machine ever be alive? Can it be conscious? And the interesting thing about these three questions is people have such radically different views about how to answer them. So with regards to jobs, just to take one of them, you have some people who say, you know, we're going to enter this permanent Great Depression and a lot of people won't find work. And then you find people who say, dream on. Machines will be able to do everything better than people. They'll write better poetry. Or you have people who say, look, this is no different than any other technology that people just use to increase their own productivity, and we're not going to have any unemployment. And you get these like radically different views from, you know, legendary giants in their field. With regards to should we be afraid of AI, you've got Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking and Bill Gates saying they're worried about it. And then you have people who think that position is so ridiculous, like Zuckerberg, you know, who says that's just irresponsible, is I think how he describes it. Mm-hmm. So I got interested in these questions as just a person trying to sort out why do all of these smart, informed people have such dramatically different views on these questions. And so what I figured out is that not that they somehow know something that other people don't know, it's that they believe things. That in the end, these questions boil down to a belief system about the nature of reality and the nature of humanity and whether we're machines or not, and all of these other kinds of philosophical questions are not really even technical questions. And so I wanted to write a book that explored it. And because of that, the book never really says what I think about any of those questions. It isn't, I didn't want to just be another person with an opinion I want everybody else to agree with. What I wanted to do was ask my reader a series of questions and then kind of work through the implications of those answers. And so to be more of a trusted guide than just a guy with an opinion. And so I wrote a book that's kind of how do you think about these technologies?
Right. Yeah, I would agree. That's what it seems like to me too. You've kind of laid the groundwork for having a productive discussion, maybe between people who don't necessarily come at it in the same way. So, I think it would be fair to say that this book is dealing with big ideas, as you've kind of already alluded to. And to put those grand themes in context, you begin by giving a very broad overview of history in order to describe what you see as the four ages of human history as defined by major technological advancements. So let's start with that. Can you tell us about these four ages?
Yeah, you know, it's unfortunate that like other books are out at the same time that are the fourth this or the fourth that. Like the world is awash in these fourths, and so it can be a little confusing. What I looked at, what I thought was interesting, is over the course of time that humans have been humans, we've used technology, and we've used it to, like I said earlier, multiply what we're able to do. But sometimes a technology comes along, it's so big and so profound that it alters the trajectory of the human race forever. I think the first of these was a technology called speech. And, when you can't imagine humans today without speech. It's like when we acquired speech, that was our singular ability as a species. It allowed us to coordinate our actions. And that was, I think, a pivotal turning point. And then I think the second one is when we got agriculture. In and of itself, that isn't, I don't think, the big one. But what happened is agriculture gave us the city. Because we stopped wandering around, we started building cities. And cities gave us the division of labor. And the division of labor gave us prosperity. And so I think that, the birth of prosperity would be the second one. And then I think the third one was two technologies that coincidentally happened at the same time. One is the invention of the wheel, and one is the invention of writing. And what those two technologies did is, taken together, they're what you need to have a nation state. And that's why 5,000 years ago, when these two technologies emerged all over the world, just kind of overnight, you had great empires come out of nowhere. You had Mesoamerica, Mesopotamia, the Indus, the Po, because these technologies just kind of came together and they made the moment. And so we had nations after that. And so I think that artificial intelligence and robots are the same kind of thing, because in a way we use technology to kind of outsource things we used to do ourselves. So like, use writing to outsource memory. If you think about it, artificial intelligence in a way is outsourcing thought, and robots are outsourcing action. And if all of a sudden you build machines that outsource, you know, that take over thinking and acting, then you have a very interesting question about what are people for? Like, what then?
So you talk also about what you call three foundational questions, which you say are philosophical questions rather than technical ones, and that how these questions are answered will determine whether sentient robots, for example, will ever be technologically possible. So tell us what you mean by that.
So the three questions that I pose my reader, the first one is, what are you? And you get, they're all multiple choice. So your three answers are, you are a machine, and everything in you just obeys the laws of physics. The second choice you have is that you're an animal, and that's like your body is mechanistic, but you have this property which is life, which may not be mechanistic. And then the third choice is that you're a human, that somehow, yes, you're an animal, but you have something extra. Like you have consciousness, or you have a soul, or you have something that makes you different. That's the first question. I'll breeze through the next two. The second one is, what is the nature of reality? It's an old debate about monism versus dualism. Is everything just atoms, or are there these other things which are mental states that have an equally valid reality, like pain? And then the third question is, what is the self? Like that voice you hear in your head, that you, like what is that? And there are three choices for that. Brain scientists say it's just a trick of the brain. It's this clever trick the brain learned, where all the different parts of the brain put reason in a way that They integrate all your sensory inputs, sound and sight and all of that. They integrate them into one whole experience, and that gives you the illusion of being you. The second choice is that it's something that's emergent, which is emergence is a poorly understood concept whereby the whole of something takes on characteristics none of the parts have. So you have a sense of humor, but your cells individually don't. Like, where did that sense of humor come from? And then the third choice is that yourself is your soul or some non-corporeal part of you. And depending on how you answer those, so I think people in Silicon Valley believe they are machines. I don't want to just paint that, you know, the whole peninsula that way, but I host a podcast about AI. I have AI experts on it. And out of 70 guests, only four would answer the question that, you know, anything other than machine. And that mechanistic view of the world says if we're machines, and someday we'll be able to build a mechanical person. And over time, that mechanical person will get better and better and better and better. And that's a view of the world. If, on the other hand, I have on my website like a test you take that kind of helps you figure out where you are on that. If you're one of the 85% of people in the rest of the country that don't believe you're a machine, which is what I have found, like from the people that have taken it online, then it doesn't stand to reason you can build a mechanical human or mechanical brain. Likewise, you ask specifically about consciousness. So people say we don't know what consciousness is, and that's not exactly right. We know exactly what it is. We just don't know how it comes about. So what it is it's the experience of being you. It is the difference between a computer can measure temperature, right? You can feel warmth. And that difference, that's consciousness. And that's the thing we don't know how we are. If you identify yourself as like something like your soul, then it's unlikely we can manufacture that in a fab. If you think your self, for instance, is a trick of the brain, then we can probably build computers that have that same trick. So that's how I set it up. I mean, that's whizzing through it, but that's the basic idea, is taking your answers to those three questions and just walking through, what does that mean for jobs? What does that mean for warfare? What does that mean for all of these other things? And the reason I don't weigh in on them, it isn't because I'm being coy or something like that. It doesn't really matter whether I think I have a soul or not. It matters whether the reader thinks they have one. So my opinion on what I am is irrelevant. All that matters is what the reader thinks they are, because the reader will already have an opinion about what they are. That's not a hard question for them to answer. And my job is to say, well, given that, here's what I think logically follows from it. I don't believe that anyone should say, well, Elon and Gates and Hawking are brilliant and they're in technology, therefore their opinions are worth more than my opinion. Their opinions matter more. They are more likely to be accurate, like they're smarter or anything like that. I emphatically reject it. What matters is what you believe. That's what informs these issues. It isn't some arcane technical knowledge about whether computers can be conscious. It's the simple question of what are we and what is reality?
Yeah, I think these are just the most fascinating questions in the area. I mean, they've always been questions in the area of philosophy, but the fact that they are so much a part of the technological discussion these days is, I just think, so interesting. We live in really interesting times, I think.
I will say something kind of that surprised me, because when I meet people who've read the book, I say, how did you answer the three questions? And they tell me. And then I say, what do you think I think as the writer? And 100% of the time, 100% of the time, they tell me exactly their three answers, which I feel good about, because what happens is the arguments I'm making for that position resonate with them. And they're like, exactly. I agree. And then the arguments I make for the contrary positions are like, yeah, whatever. I don't buy that. So I hope it means that I've represented every possible combination of those answers in a way that people who hold that position say, yep, he's just like me. Byron's just like me. And so far, that's been the case, but it's only been like a dozen people I've had that conversation with.
That's fascinating. I felt like your even-handedness came across to me. I'm not sure I would know what to guess. Oh, I mean, you've already told me that I can't guess, but yeah, I'm not sure what I would have guessed had you asked. But
what do you mean I told you can't guess?
Well, no, just that you already set up the punchline in a sense that other people were always guessing the answers that they themselves had. So that's tainted my answer now a little bit, I think. But I'm not sure that I would have been able to venture a guess, because it really did come across to me as being even-handed.
Well, thank you. Like I said, I don't make my opinions, I don't hide them. I host a podcast on the topic where I'm quite opinionated about it. But that would be the appropriate venue for me to say where I am.
Interesting. All right. So in your next section, you start with covering what the current technological reality is as it pertains to our capabilities, with what you term narrow AI as well as robots. So let's start with AI. Your average consumer hears about artificial intelligence a lot these days, including frequent but vague claims about how it presumably makes pretty much any product or service better. But most people don't have a very clear idea about what this means or how it's done. So can you shed some light here?
Well, first of all, it should come as no surprise that people don't have a good sense of it, because there's no agreed upon definition of what artificial intelligence is. Furthermore, there's no agreed upon definition of what intelligence is at all. It's one of those words like life and death that somehow we never can agree. We kind of know what they are, but we can never agree on a definition of them. And this has presented problems, because what it means is that if you have a cat food dish that automatically refills when it's empty, you can say that's artificial intelligence because it responds to its environment. I mean, it really is. Likewise, if you watch, you know, Star Trek or Star Wars and you see Commander Data or you see C-3PO, you can say those are artificial intelligence, and they are. And so the most important distinction to draw is that, broadly speaking, AI falls into two big buckets. And one of them is narrow AI, which is a computer that can do one thing very well. So you think about it, can your email program can spot spam very well, but don't ask it to make coffee. You probably are routed through traffic with a narrow AI that knows how to do that, but can't do anything else. And then there's artificial general intelligence, and that is an AI that is as smart and versatile as a human. It is creative. It can learn new things. It can do anything a person can do. And we don't know how to build that. Nobody does. Or if they do, they haven't told anybody. 99% of the effort in the world, actually more than that, is for narrow AI. Let's build an artificial intelligence to solve some problem. And there's multiple techniques on how you do it, but the one that is kind of doing the best lately is machine learning. And machine learning sounds like a kind of a foreboding topic, but it's really very simple. It says, let's take a bunch of data about the past, study it, and project into the future. That's all it is. It doesn't do anything beyond that. So, and it only works for certain kinds of problems where the future and the past are very similar. So if you wanted to build a program that could pick out cats in photographs, you would take a million photos of cats from the past, and you would get the computer to study those and make predictions in future photographs about whether that's a cat or not. We can do this because cats don't really change. If you tried to, you know, do cell phones and you trained it on data from the 1990s, it wouldn't do very well because a cell phone of tomorrow looks different than a cell phone of the past. So that's all the technology is. But the reason it kind of grabs headlines is because we're getting so much better at doing it. And we're better at doing it for two reasons. We can collect data much faster now with cheap sensors. And our computers are much faster. So the kinds of techniques that people use in AI have been written about since the 60s. We kind of always knew you could do this. We just never had computers to do it. And now we do. And now they're, I guess there's a third reason too, and that is that there are now toolkits available so that I can sit down and to give you one example, there was a Google employee, a Japanese Google employee, whose parents owned a cucumber farm, and they had to sort the cucumbers based on four characteristics: how big they are, how bumpy they are, how green they are, and how straight they are. And this employee's mother spent all day sorting cucumbers. And so he was able to program with an Arduino and basically with inexpensive components, he was able to build an AI that could sort cucumbers based on those four factors. And so you can do that because all the toolkits are so friendly now that you can solve a lot of different kinds of problems. So that's what we know how to build. That's what people are worried about is going to take all the jobs, by the way. That's where that worry comes from. This other thing, this general intelligence, that's what people are afraid of when Elon Musk says it's, quote, an existential threat. When they talk about, when Stephen Hawking says it might be the last invention we're allowed to make, or words to that effect, they're worried about this technology we don't know how to build. If you ask people in AI, when are we going to get a general intelligence? You get answers between 5 and 500 years. And that's kind of a clue. Nobody knows what they're talking about, because if you dropped your dry cleaning off and they said it'll be ready in 5 to 500 days, it's like, that is absolutely meaningless to me. But it's the reason people vary so much is they have differing opinions about five kind of fundamental questions about intelligence. And depending on what you think about those five questions, whether you're a 500-year person or a five-year person or somewhere in between. The consensus is about, the average is about 20, 25 years. But the funny thing is that it's always been 20 to 25 years out, which also I find to be a little suspicious. So those are the two technologies. Narrow AI, we know how to do. It's good for a certain set of problems. Automation, and then general intelligence. I can only think of one or two companies working on it, and most people aren't. And I'll just say one more thing, because it's probably too arcane. It's an open question whether the two technologies are related at all. It isn't the case that people believe you build a narrow AI and then another one, then another one, then another one, then another one, and you bolt them together like Frankenstein, and you get, you know, an AI that's like a human. I would say, I ask this question of my guests a lot on my podcast, and I would say 60% of people say they're unrelated technologies. Like a general intelligence is something completely different. We're not even working on it yet.
That's a really interesting point, because of course that involves inference analysis and a whole bunch of like lateral capabilities that have nothing to do with the goals of a narrow AI. So that makes a lot of sense. I haven't really heard it put that way before, though. It's interesting that you mentioned too how the ones that do predict like 25 years, for example, you see a similar kind of thing happen in biology with the so-called key to life. Basically, for the last 100 years, there have been some biologists that are arguing that we're going to figure out that key to life like within 25 years, and they've been arguing 25 years for the last 100. So it's sort of like science speak for we don't really know, I think.
I agree. I think it's conveniently far enough out that nobody's going to hold you to it if you're wrong, but it's conveniently close enough that you're going to live to see it.
And it seems around the corner.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, let's move on to robots. You begin with a history of robots as an imagined figure, which is that's a study close to my heart. I did my master's thesis on something close to that. I looked at the history of the cyborg and how it has been gendered through science fiction throughout history. Actually, before science fiction, too, going back to the 1600s and depictions of mechanical humans.
And when you say gender, do you mean how they've been represented?
Yeah, so in fictional imaginings of personified machines, there's a tendency towards making it female and also vilifying it. And you touch on that in your book, because you talk about how somehow, inevitably, these robots, it always ends up as a conversation about our deepest fears about robots. You talk about the Czech play, which is where we get the robot from, and, you know, it turns into a robot resistance and overthrow, and they'd kill people. And then you can think of Metropolis, very early movie. And there you really see the woman, she becomes this witch. You have to burn at the stake to restore order and whatnot. So yeah, that's fun stuff.
But that movie, you know, is still the most expensive movie made adjusted for inflation ever.
Wow.
And it was Metropolis.
Yeah.
And it was so trailblazing in the sense of the special effects and everything that it did. It's horribly dated in places, but it's still eminently watchable. Like, it's not one of those things that you just kind of can't make it through. It's just, but you're entirely right. Anyway, keep going.
Oh, well, let's turn to you, because this is where you start to talk about robots. The history of them as an imagined figure and how they resemble our fears or bring to life our fears.
So they do go way back, thousands of years. They're in writing. I think Plutarch says that, well, anyway, they're in ancient Greece.
Yeah, there's Pygmalion.
Right. And they're said to have guarded the Isle of I'm drawing a blank. Anyway, there's these walking tripods.
God makes them in his workshop, and they serve the gods as well. And
Exactly. And they're of course not mechanical. They're animated by magic of some kind. In one telling of the Prometheus myth, the eagle that rips out his liver is a robotic eagle.
Huh.
And so all along they are depicted as animated by, you know, a mechanism hitherto unexplained. And then we come across to the scientific era, and all of a sudden science animates them. And of course, what jumps to mind immediately is Frankenstein,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, it's alive. And
kill it.
Yeah. And they are odd in the sense that they are human enough. They're always, of course, not about – the stories are never about the robots. They're about us and our reaction to them. And I think it's very telling that we keep telling stories about these mechanical people and all the problems they cause us.
Yeah, I would agree.
And of course – well, go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, unlike a lot of naysayers, you're actually pretty bullish about the future of humans alongside robots. Like, you don't think that there's fear that they're going to take all the jobs and so forth.
Well, that is correct. I mean, look, on the job question, like I said, there are three camps. They're going to take some jobs, and we're going to have like a permanent Great Depression. They're going to take all the jobs, because once a computer can learn to do something faster than a human, it's game over. Every new job that comes along, they'll learn it faster and better than us, or they're going to take none. I write about both all three of them, and I try to make the case for and against both all of them. But I'm firmly in the camp. We're not going to have any unemployment from these things. And the way I would probably, if somebody said, well, why do you think that? I would say this, that I think the half-life of a job is about 50 years. So I think every 50 years, half the jobs vanish. I think between 1850 and 1900, half the agricultural jobs went, 1900 to 1950, another half, 1950 to 2000, half the manufacturing jobs. Half the jobs vanished, many of which were manufacturing, but, you know, switchboard operators, elevator operators, all of these things. So we have always had, I think every 50 years, half the jobs just go.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it.
It's been hard to figure out exactly what it is, because in a way, the job doesn't vanish. What happens is the number of people who have the job, like there's still candle makers today. There just are far fewer of them than when that was our sole form of life. But as near as I can tell, and I've put a bunch of energy in figuring this out, it's 45 to 50 years. I just say 50 years. It's a good shorthand. And yet, here's the interesting thing. And yet, aside from the Great Depression, which wasn't caused by technology, in the United States, in the last 250 years, unemployment has always been between 5 and 10%. Always. And it isn't the case that electricity comes out and it jumps to 12%, or the assembly line is invented and it jumps to 17%. You can get unemployment numbers for 250 years and graph them out, and you can start putting a pencil on the points where great innovations happen and nothing happens to the line. It doesn't go up or down. And you say, well, how can that happen? And the reason it happens is because there's not a finite number of jobs. It's a fallacy called the lump of labor theory. There's an infinite number of jobs, and they can instantly be created by anybody. When you take something like a lump of clay and you add labor and technology to it and you make something else like a vase, you just made a job. And whatever value you were able to add, that's a wage. And what happens is technology magnifies what you're able to do. Therefore, you with technology can increase wages, your own wage, because you can do more. You can make more vases in that example. You can use power tools to make more bookcases or what have you. And then people say this argument that goes like this. They say, look, technology is really good at creating great new jobs like a geneticist. But it destroys jobs like order taker at a fast food place. And then they say this. This is the part I encourage people to always listen for. They say, do you really think that order taker is going to be a geneticist? Come on. And the answer to the question is no, of course not. A biologist, a college biology professor becomes a geneticist, and a high school biology teacher gets the college job, and a substitute teacher gets hired on to replace the biology, the full-time teacher, all the way down the line. So the question isn't, can that order taker become a geneticist? The question is, can everybody do a job a little bit harder than the job they have today? And I personally think the answer to that is yes. And so what happens is, for 250 years in this country, technology makes great new jobs, destroys bad jobs, and everybody shifts up one notch. And then it makes some great new jobs, destroys some bad jobs. Everybody shifts up a notch. And that is how come in this country you can have 250 years of rising wages and full employment while technology is disrupting everything. Every 50 years, half the jobs are vanishing. And that's, to me, the narrative. That's 250 years of history. So to say that's going to be different going forward, you have to say one of two things. You have to say this time is different. It's either different because it's happening faster than before, and so it's just swamping everything, or the kinds of jobs it's replacing are different. With regards to the first one, is it happening faster? I'm highly unconvinced. You're already starting on a base where half the jobs are vanishing every 50 years, so you're going to have to somehow show that it's going to happen faster than that. You think about the internet. And if 25 years ago, the Mosaic browser came out, and if you had said to somebody who was very smart and forward-looking, you said, hey, in 25 years, billions of people are going to use this internet thing, this web thing. What do you think is going to happen with employment? Here's what they would have said. They would have said, well, that's going to be really hard on the yellow pages, and really hard on the newspapers, and really hard on the stockbrokers, and really hard on the travel agents. And you would have been right about it all, everything. But what you would never have seen is Google and Amazon and Etsy and eBay and Uber and Airbnb. You would have never seen literally a million companies that were started because of the internet. You never would have seen all those jobs that were created. You just can't. You just can't from that perspective. So what we can always do is say we can see the jobs that automation will take, but it's just harder to see the ones that it's going to create. But it always does. And so the second thing you have to say is somehow the jobs that are being replaced by AI are different. And again, I don't have any reason to believe that either. You know, we made calculators a long time ago, and they do math better than any person. And yet we still have mathematicians. Like, it's still mental work that the machine's doing. And that doesn't mean that we no longer need those people. You know, when the ATM came out, everybody said, oh, automatic teller machine, we know what that means. No more tellers. And in reality, you have more bank tellers today than you had when it came out. Google Translate can translate as well as a human. And if you look at the Bureau of Labor and Statistics and look at their projections, the world needs vastly more translators now because Google Translate lowers the cost of, you know, translating an email to zero. But when it comes to a contract or you've got to have a phone conversation or you've got to localize a product to local customs or you've got to come up with a name for a product in another language or anything else, you need people. And so I don't think these technologies eat jobs any differently than anything else. And I don't have any reason to believe we're losing more than half the jobs per 50 years. Yeah. There are just so many things that machines can't do. I mean, they can't, I've got a robot jobs test on my website and ask you 10 questions. You pick any job and ask you 10 questions about it, and you score them. Does it require mobility? Does it require empathy? Does it require, would two people do the job the exact same way, and so forth? And what happens is there are darn few jobs. You know, think about an electrician. Like, how would you ever build a robotic electrician that can come in and like walk around your room and figure out, you know, where the studs are? How would you ever build a robotic plumber? I mean, any of that. It's like, look out your window and or just think of like every aunt and uncle you have and what they do for a living. And then try to think about, can you imagine a machine doing that job? And unfortunately, there are a lot of jobs that the machines just can't do, jobs we would love them to do, like, you know, come in and plunge the toilet when it stopped up or something. Unfortunately, they can't do that. You know, there are all these things that you kind of wish you could build machines to do that you can't.
I think you present a convincing case. I tend to be a bit of a technological optimist anyways, but I tend to agree with that for all the reasons you mentioned. So next, in the next section, you get a little bit deeper into artificial general intelligence, which we've discussed already. And you start by talking about the functioning of the human brain. So I think for the sake of pointing out just how little we truly know about intelligence, which you mentioned before. So tell us about this and how they're connected.
So I am fascinated by this topic. I learned so much about the brain writing this book. And I'll start off by saying we don't know how brains encode thoughts. Like if I were to ask you the color of your first bicycle or something like that, you can recall it. But it's not like there's some spot in your brain where, you know, the list of colors of first whatevers are stored. So that's a big mystery. And your brain has 100 billion neurons, and they all fire at each other, you know, electrical impulses. And there's a lot of other complexity going on. And people sometimes say, well, we just don't understand it because there are so many neurons. But it turns out that's not true. There's a worm called the nematode worm, and they're about as long as a hair is thick, and they're everywhere. And that nematode worm has a brain and has 302 neurons. That's it, 302. And there have been there's been a project called the Open Worm Project, which has tried to model those 302 neurons in a computer to get it to behave like a worm would behave. And that seems straightforward, right? If you know how a neuron behaves, just put 302 together and it should be like a nematode worm. It should be able to find food and seek out a mate and move towards light and all these other things actual nematode worms do.
Right, because a neuron is just like a one or a zero, right? On or off. So it does.
Well, no, it's analog because it can fire in differing intensities.
Okay.
And then there are glial cell, there's all this other stuff going on. And the punchline of the story is they've been at it for 20 years. And people in the project still to this day don't even know if it's going to be possible. So we just don't understand how the brain works. I had a brain scientist on my podcast who said it's not quite so bleak. And he made a case that we know more than I was letting on. And so in fairness, I will say that. Okay. But we don't know how the brain basically functions. But that's not actually the problem with artificial intelligence, because what you have to do is come to the concept of the mind. And the mind is the brain's just an organ. It's like a liver or a stomach. But the mind is this word we use to describe all these things that organ can do that seem quite mysterious. Like you mentioned, you have a sense of humor. That comes from your mind. Your liver probably doesn't have a sense of humor. Your stomach doesn't get upset. Well, I mean, I guess you do get an upset stomach. Your stomach doesn't get, you know, involved in politics. It doesn't care. But somehow the brain does. The brain has this emergent property. It becomes a mind. And it has creativity. Like, where does that come from? Where do creative ideas come from? All of that. And we have no idea on that. The catch-all is that it's emergent. And emergence is a fascinating concept. It's where, like I said, the whole of something takes on, has properties that none of the components have. And so it's kind of a, you can kick the can down the street a little bit and just say, ah, it's emergence. But that doesn't explain anything. Because, how does it emerge? How does creativity come about? And so even if you get to the mind, and by the way, you need a mind to have a general intelligence, because it's got to be creative. Even if you get to a mind, you're still not home, because you don't have consciousness. Because you can have a mind with no consciousness. That would be like...
like the nematode worm.
Right. Right. Like, have you ever had that sense of when you're driving, you kind of space, and then a minute later, you're like, whoa, I don't remember driving here. That minute is kind of like you're intelligent, like you were merging in traffic and all that, but you weren't conscious. You weren't experiencing the world. And we don't know how consciousness comes about. So to build a general intelligence, you may or may not need consciousness. We don't know. It may be that consciousness, our ability to experience the world instead of just measure it, is key to our intelligence. It certainly seems to be key to our ability to shift focus. And it seems maybe to be involved in our ability to imagine alternate realities. I don't mean that in any weird way. Like, now if I pull that lion, if I pull that saber-toothed tiger's tail, what's going to happen? You know, to like be able to picture different scenarios of the future. That may be, we just don't know. And so to make a general intelligence would require a lot of that kind of stuff we just don't know how to do. Now, then there are people who say, we may make a general intelligence without ever understanding how humans are intelligent. And there's a big multi-billion dollar project in Europe to basically build a computer neuron and bolt a bunch of them together and see what walks out of the, see what wakes up. It hasn't been going well, but I do it at a service to mention, it's called the Human Brain Project. I do it at a service to mention it so cavalierly. I mean, they're brilliant people who are doing real science, and they're well-funded and so forth. But some people say we're going to get to an intelligence without understanding how humans are. And it is true that it may be a situation that you can evolve it. You can write a program that evolves intelligence easier than you can actually program intelligence. Maybe. Nobody knows.
Right, through kind of like this cumulative machine learning style.
When they plugged Ultron into the internet, it took him 15 minutes to decide to wipe out the whole human race. And that's what we don't have right now. We don't have what's known as an unsupervised learner. We don't have any technology that we can point at the internet, for instance, and just say, go figure everything out. We just don't know how learning happens either. I mean, the list is almost endless. You know, if you take a child and show them four pictures of a cat, and they know what a cat is, and then they might be walking around and see a Manx cat, you know, one of those without a tail, and they'll say, oh, look, there's a kitty without a tail. And nobody ever told them there was such a thing as a cat without a tail. And yet somehow they know the essential component of catness doesn't require a tail. But if it was barking, for instance, that would be different. That would invalidate it. If I were to ask you if I said, hey, imagine a trout in a jar of formaldehyde in a laboratory. And then imagine you just caught a trout of the same size. And I said, are those two trout, do they weigh the same? You would say, yes. Are they the same temperature? You would say, probably not. And then I'd say, are they the same color? And you would say, not really. And so forth. And you can go through this whole litany, and instantly you're able to apply knowledge that you learned from one area to something you probably don't have a lot of experience with, trout and formaldehyde. So humans do this magic thing where we can effortlessly take knowledge we learn from one place, and we know what parts of it transfer over and what parts don't. And we don't know how we do this. And there's so many things we don't know about human intelligence that it can be discouraging if you happen to be hoping we build a general intelligence, because I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon if it happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I will say this, though. So if you start with that, you say, we have brains we don't understand, and they give rise to minds which we don't understand, and we are conscious which we don't understand, but we're going to build that someday. The only way you can say that is if you believe it's all mechanistic, if you believe we're just machines. Because then you say, yes, we're going to build that all day. How do I know? Because we're just machines. We obey the laws of physics. So whatever is going on in us, we'll eventually be able to do. And that's where it kind of gets back to the questions. If you don't believe you're a machine, then there's kind of no reason to think we can ever build that. I will say, though, the AI people on my show, I can only think of a very few, two or something, that don't believe we can ever build a general intelligence. So the overwhelming consensus in people in AI is that we can build a general intelligence, even though nobody knows how. But it's all based on that one assumption that it's a mechanistic process.
Yeah, and you said that about 60% of them are of that, or did you say more than that, are of the mechanistic view of humanity?
No, virtually all of them. What I would say about 60% is don't believe that a narrow AI and a general AI have anything in common.
That's it. Okay.
But virtually all of them. Esther Dyson said, machine won't have a soul. Like, so she kind of laid it out there on the line, and that's what she said. And I can think of a couple of other people who've said, we can't build it. We just can't.
Okay, so they all think that humanity or the emergent sense of self is mechanistic, correct, and therefore we can build it eventually.
Yeah, and the funny thing is when I wrote that in my book about are you a machine? My editor, you know, who lives in New York City, wrote in the margin, "Come on, does anybody believe that?" And I was like, everybody on the other side of the country in that industry believes that. Everybody.
So let's talk about the ethical implications of some of the, putting aside the question of whether or not we can do AGI or computer consciousness. You touch upon the ethical questions that are raised if we were to be able to do these kinds of things. So can you speak to that?
Well, I think the first question you have to ask is, does the machine then have rights? And if it has rights, can you enslave it to do your work for you? You know, if it can feel pain, for instance, or it has a sense of self, is it ethical to make it, you know, clean your house? Or have you not just perpetuated a travesty that, you know, we seem to be finally starting to get rid of, namely slavery, which is, you know, illegal in every country on the planet, finally. But have you essentially made a whole new kind of slave? Furthermore, how you treat a potentially conscious or sentient actually means able to sense things, able to feel things like pain. Then you kind of have to give it rights, because we base rights off things' ability to feel pain. You assume a dog can, which, by the way, veterinarians in the United States up until the 90s were taught animals don't feel pain and you don't have to anesthetize them. They also operated on babies under the same theory. They did open heart surgery on newborns under the theory they couldn't feel pain.
That's crazy.
in the 90s. I mean, I'm not talking about, you know, back in the 1840s.
I was shocked when I read that. I just couldn't.
I know. I fact checked that like 12 ways to Sunday because it's so. But it's very well documented, and and so we say if something can feel pain, it has the right not to be tortured. And the interesting thing, of course, is how would you know? Because the robot could very easily say, "I feel pain." For any number of reasons, like it would get out of work. Who knows why, right? But it could say it, but you wouldn't actually know. And I point out that, you know, trees, we share half our DNA with a tree, and you wouldn't know if a tree felt pain, would you? Because it can't tell you. So how would you know if a machine could feel pain? And it could very easily feel pain and not be able to report it. So it's all replete. And then, and this is a kind of a more minor issue, but we clawed our way to a point as a species where we have these things called human rights. And the basic idea is there are certain things you just do not do to any human being, regardless. Torture for entertainment. You just don't do it, regardless of what the person did, because being a human gives you, there's a certain dignity about that that is inviolable or should be. Now, the question is, if we start making robots that look like people and talk like people and have people's names, but aren't, I see how people abuse robots right now. I think I wrote in the book about in Japan, there was this robot that they put in a shopping mall to see how people reacted to it. And little kids would abuse it. And it quickly learned that if it saw a bunch of short people, that is children, and no tall person with them, it needed to run off to find a tall person. And the kids actually thought they were inflicting, that it had emotional distress. They asked them later. Likewise, we all probably, you know, I have those devices on my desk, the ones put out by Amazon and Google. I can't say their names because they'll start talking. But when I ask it a question, if it starts to say something, I just say, stop. You know, I just interrupt it. I just cut it off. Right? And, I hear my kids do the same thing. But it's, and you wonder if any of that has any numbing effect on the notion of human rights. I don't know. So there's the basic questions are, how do you treat a robot ethically if it's conscious? And how do you program them to behave ethically? That's another big challenge because, as you know, no two people agree on what ethical behavior is or isn't. And even if you just say, well, we're just going to pick one person, people's ethical codes are so complex and so full of provisos and special circumstances that you kind of can't, it would be very hard to encode it. The how do you teach a robot to behave ethically? You know, Isaac Asimov famously had his three laws. A computer can't harm a person. A robot can't harm a person. Or through an action, allow one to become harmed. It can't. Anyway, he sets this up as, but they don't actually get you very far because if you are about to have a second dessert, should the computer like take the pie away from you because you're harming yourself, which is very different than if you're, and then if your company goes public and you light a big cigar, should the robot douse you with water because you're. But if you hold a gun to your head and you're going to kill yourself or you're going to jump, I mean, it just, you can't do it almost. So we don't know how to program a robot to behave ethically. We wouldn't know how to treat one ethically if it warranted it because it could experience the world. And we wouldn't even know if it could experience the world.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to your original theme of the four great ages in human history, as demarcated by transformative technological advancement, and put the emergence of robots and AI together in the fourth age there. Tell us about how you view progress and technology's role in it going forward.
You know, the great challenge in human history has been that there hasn't been enough of the good stuff for everybody. There was never, you know, it took 90% of us to grow our food. And sometimes there wasn't even enough food then, and we would have famine and people would die. And there wasn't enough education for everybody, and there wasn't enough medical care for everybody. And one thing after the other, our entire history is defined by scarcity, that there just hasn't been enough of the good stuff. And somehow we managed to make progress, a lot of progress. 100,000 years ago, by one estimate, we were down to and this is based on genetics, the genetic diversity among humans. The theory is that we were down to 1,000 breeding pairs of humans. And so by any definition of today, we were an endangered species. You know, we hung by this precarious thread. And somehow, in a world where every day was a fight to just live, we created civilization and prosperity, and we took care of the old and the weak and all of these other things. And we created human rights and habeas corpus and democracy and legal equal status between men and women and all of this other stuff that we somehow managed to do in spite of having kind of so little in a way. And we did it because we learned this trick of technology, that with technology, you can multiply what you're able to do. Your body uses 100 watts of power, and that's it. But we use artificial power, and in the United States, we use 10,000 watts constantly per person. So it's like we've put 100 other people to work for us just with electricity. And so we've learned to multiply what we're able to do. I don't know about you, but I don't work harder than my great-grandparents. Yet I live a much more lavish life than they ever dreamed of. Why? Because I have technology. I don't haul up water by the bucket load from the well half a mile away. I just turn on a tap. You know, I don't wash my clothes down at the river on a board. I just push a button. And so what I believe is that as long as there's been civilization, there have been people who have dreamed of a world of plenty, where there's enough for everybody, enough of the good stuff for everybody, and everybody gets access to the good stuff. And that's always been kind of a utopia. It's been a dream. And I believe deeply, deeply, deeply that we're going to actually be the generation that sees that dream achieved. Not because we're any better, just because we have a lot more technology. That technology does this mysterious thing where it doubles in capability. It's not just Moore's law. All technology doubles over predictable periods, 2 years, 7 years, 9 years, depends on the technology. But what it means is that technology can grow essentially indefinitely. And so we can multiply ourselves seemingly indefinitely. And so I do believe that we are going to use these two great technologies, artificial intelligence and robotics, to create a world that we would have called a utopia. It turns out that there was utopian literature in the 1500s and 1600s and 1700s that talked about the end of slavery or freedom of religion for everyone or equality among sexes and so forth. And those aren't crazy ideas anymore. And we're on our path to achieving them. And so I think the crazy ideas of prosperity for everyone, that crazy idea is one we're going to live to see. I think it will happen sooner than anybody believes. And it will happen because technology delivers so much prosperity that there's just kind of no way to avoid it.
I hope you're right. What might be some of the unforeseen consequences, some potential negatives that you think might happen?
Well,
or do Do you predict any?
Well, I mean, there things could happen. You know, stray comet takes the planet out. unfortunately, you know, asymmetry in a world of technology, asymmetry is more pronounced. In other words, the ability of a few people to do great harm. You know, 200 years ago, if you had, if you were a lunatic and wanted to inflict as much pain, I mean, I guess you could get smallpox infected blankets or something, but you were limited in what you could do. And then, you know, a few people with box cutters hijack planes and fly them into a building. Unfortunately, technology cuts both ways, right? It increases the ability of people to do evil with it. I wouldn't worry too much about that because, like, you're always going to have crazy people. Like, even when the world is a utopia, you still get a Timothy McVeigh who comes along and blows up, you know, Oklahoma City bomber. Like, there's no way around that. There are sometimes people that are just broken. But what we do know is that more people want to create than destroy. We know that because it's easier to destroy than create, and yet the world has made progress. And so if even a sizable minority of people wanted to destroy everything, we never would have made it to where we are now. We made it to where we are because in the end, most people are good and want to help other people. Now, you may say that is overly optimistic, but I will say that nobody predicted with the internet that you would be able to go online and post a problem. And total strangers you'll never meet will write you a big, long reply on what you should do. And they don't get anything. Nobody would have ever predicted the open source movement. There'll be these people who write code and they just give it away. Nobody would have ever predicted Wikipedia, that people will labor in anonymity, I point out, and make a great encyclopedia just because they want to make the world a better place. I think we all have a natural desire to want to help other people. We're a completely social species, and we, you know, there's a reason solitary confinement is a punishment, because in the end, we want to connect with other people. And so I'm completely optimistic.
Fantastic. Well, finally, I also want to ask you a couple of questions about your process, because this book was a fun one to read with a lot of creative examples, historical tidbits, and stories throughout to help illustrate your points. And you also cover a really broad range of material. So my questions are about your research. It must have been extensive. So how did you know when to quit? And did you have as much fun researching it as it seems?
Yeah, I mean, I do something kind of strange that I don't want to suggest is normative. Like, I don't go around saying, here's what you should do. But I will say what I do, which is every morning I wake up. I'm sure everybody does that. Then I pull up my newsreader of choice, and I just skim over headlines, probably 600 or 700 every morning.
Oh, and, wow.
Well, I'm just reading headlines. And I take screen captures of things that look interesting to me. And then I go on to Reddit and I read Today I Learned, or, I scan through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Reddit posts every day. And I just take screen captures of things that look interesting. And then, I love to read things I don't agree with, because there's no point in reading something you agree with in a way, because it's like you read it and you're like, yep, that's what I used. That's what I think. So I have all of these like places that I go every day, and I just skim headlines and I take screen captures on my iPad. Then I go into my office, I plug my iPad in, and I probably have 20 screen captures, and I just rename the files, some words from those headlines. I don't even necessarily read the article, just some words. And I have done that every day for years and years and years and years. So that if I decide I want to write about aluminum production or something, I just go into this one colossally large photo and folder, excuse me, and look for the word aluminum. And I look all those articles up and I read them. And so I'm mainly just looking for things that catch my eye, things that look interesting. And then, and sometimes I just go through that folder and just read through thousands and thousands and thousands of file names and just to remind myself they're in there. And so that's how I do it. Like I said, I don't know if anybody else would find that remotely useful, but to me,
it seems to me that you're an information hoarder. And because I do a little bit of the same, not with the screen captures, but I use other methods, but it's similar. Like I just bank and bank and bank, and I use keywords and ways that I can go back and search those topics in case I want to drill down further. But
Exactly. And so I don't actually usually have to go out and look for anything. It's usually already here. For years, I was interested in consciousness and artificial intelligence and AGI and all of that. So I have been collecting headlines for years. So I do have to go read it all eventually, but I don't have to go looking for it. And that's what takes all the time.
Fascinating. Okay. Well, Byron, I've taken up a lot of your time. I really appreciate it.
Fun.
Good.
When my next book comes out, I hope you will have me back.
Well, actually, that was my second question. I was going to ask you what you're currently working on.
I am writing another book, and another idiosyncratic thing is I never talk about it because I have found that if I talk about it, I lose vitality, I lose energy, I lose excitement. I'm tired of it by the time I have to sit down and write it because I've like talked about it, and so I never talk about it. But I'm writing a book now, another book that's I hope to be done with it in 3 months or so.
Okay, well, yeah, please do get in touch. I would love to talk with you again.
All righty. Well, thanks a bunch.
Okay, thanks so much. I want to thank you for listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Once again, I'm Carrie Lynn Evans, and I've been speaking with Byron Rees about his book, The Fourth Age, Smart Robots, Conscious Computers, and the Future of Humanity. If you enjoyed this podcast, please write us a positive review on iTunes, post about us on social media, or tell a friend. The New Books Network is a not-for-profit organization, so all the buzz you can help us generate goes a long way to supporting this work. Have you written a book you'd like covered on one of our shows? Contact us through our website, newbooksnetwork.com. Also, be sure to like the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society channel on Facebook and Twitter, where you'll see every time we post a new interview. And you can find me on Twitter at Carrie Lynland. That's at CarrieLynland. Did you find this book fascinating? Let me know. I'd love to hear what you think. And goodbye. Until the next time.